Thank you. So I do not have any relationships to disclose. And I wanted to point out that this project was funded by an internal grant that the University of Massachusetts Commonwealth Medicine Group gives. These are called mini grants, and there's an annual cycle for them for seed money for background research and development of larger proposals. So as a bit of background, there's been a tremendous focus recently on understanding the use of emergency rooms, particularly in terms of preventable and avoidable utilization. And a lot of these strategies have focused on looking at vulnerable populations and trying to enhance community-based care for these groups in an effort to reduce this type of utilization. There's been a number of different models that have been developed to try to discern what type of utilization is preventable or avoidable versus necessary. And there also have been previous studies showing that the broader approaches on a population-based level do a better job of reducing this type of unnecessary utilization than individual diversion programs. So we found this is particularly important for vulnerable populations, and I'm going to focus today on the population with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The emergency room is a very stressful experience for most people with these disabilities, and it can be a very prolonged experience due to the complexity of their needs. This population also has significant communication barriers, and their communication skills may become compromised in the stressful situation of an emergency room. They tend to have greater numbers of comorbid conditions and complicating factors, and they may be at risk for greater harm due to their specialized needs and the unfamiliarity of the staff with their particular situations or care or support needs. Often their visits, because of these complexities, are much more expensive and may take substantially more staff resources from an emergency room. And we have not found any evidence of the examination of patterns of emergency room use in a large group of people in the United States. So a few years ago, we've started to look at this utilization for a subset of people with intellectual disabilities in Massachusetts. This was at the request of the Department of Developmental Services that we work with closely. They were trying to understand if people were receiving the best possible care. So we had information from what's called the critical incident reporting system, and this was for folks receiving residential support, so this is paid staff in a home environment in the community, or what's called individual supports. They live on their own, but they receive a lot of supports from paid staff. So this is not by any means generalizable to everyone with an intellectual disability, but it's one of the data sources we had, and it represented over 18,000 adults. So we compared this utilization to the general population, and we found that this group did use the emergency room less frequently than the general population. I think this was in alignment with our expectations because they have so many supports around them. The most common cause of an emergency room visit for both the general population and people with intellectual disabilities was falls. However, the group with intellectual disabilities used this less frequently. Instead, the most frequent utilizations that differed a bit from the general population were those due to seizures. They were at 5 times the risk. Urinary tract infections, almost double the risk. And feeding tube complications, these are G or J tubes. And we don't have a risk ratio there because there's so little information in the general population, we couldn't calculate that. The data we had asked additional questions around the visits than you would normally see in claims data, so we were able to understand whether the person had contacted or their supporters had contacted their primary care physician before going to the emergency room, and then we found in 1 in 5 times that was the case. And often the physician was sending them to the emergency room due to the severity of their condition or an inability to see them in a timely fashion. One of the theories that folks had was that people are using the emergency room on the weekends or at night when there is not a doctor's office appointment available to them. And we found that to be quite false, actually. The highest utilization was Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, during normal business hours. And we also saw that there was a subset of people, sometimes called frequent flyers, who use the emergency room many, many times, over 20 times over the course of the year. And in many cases, these folks have what's called dual diagnosis. They have mental health conditions on top of their intellectual or developmental disability. When we looked at this pattern by age, we saw substantial differences from the general population, particularly in the older age groups. So in the younger age groups, the people with intellectual disabilities in this group were less likely to use the emergency room. But that absolutely changed by around the age of 45 to 64, and substantially over the age of 65. And I think when we look at this, we need to keep in mind that we have seen that people with these disabilities tend to age at least 10 years sooner, and then by aging, I mean they develop more age-related health conditions and limitations on top of their intellectual disability. In addition, the average age of death for this population is around 60 years. So in many cases, the emergency room utilization may be closer to an elderly population, the 65 and older group, as you would see in the general population. So what this work helped us do is inform some strategies that improved the emergency room experience. We also did a survey to paid staff about best practices. And we found that there were some important things to be done around communication about the person's health conditions and needs, and making sure that that information was readily available to the emergency room staff. And we also found that making sure that people who are familiar with that person quickly came to the emergency room after they went, that really helped the visit. So sometimes a relief staff or someone who doesn't really know the person is sent with them to the emergency room, and we found that that was really setting them up for a poor visit and a poor experience, and that if as soon as possible someone who knew them could come to the emergency room to support them there, that that experience was a lot better. But we really found ourselves wondering, what else could we do? Is this a good utilization pattern? Is this what should be expected? Or was there avoidable or preventable use? So we thought that we would look at this a little bit further and see, could we use some of the existing algorithms to discern this for the population? We know that the folks, particularly in residential services, tend to have higher rates of preventive care, greater supports, higher medical needs, so we didn't feel we could generalize this to everyone with an intellectual disability. So we wanted to see if we could use other sources of data, like claims data, to get at this population, which probably has different needs. We also wanted to be able to develop more population-based strategies and more clinically relevant strategies than the current data allowed us to do. So before we applied these algorithms, we really were thinking about what we knew about this population and we knew about their utilization, and thought we need to take a step back, because it's entirely possible that the algorithms that are out there really aren't appropriate for this group, that they may lead us to a false conclusion, and we wanted to be a little bit more careful about understanding them before we applied them. We knew that these folks had complex care needs, communication challenges, which may make an emergent condition a little bit different than for the general population. So we found that there were multiple ways to define this utilization, and that some of that had been applied to Massachusetts, so we had a great benchmark. As we dug in, we found a bit of a disconnect, and I'll give some more examples of this in a bit, between how the algorithms were used and what it would be like to present in an emergency room. So some of these algorithms use a discharge diagnosis. So what was the condition that you were found to have when you left the emergency room? But if you think about a decision to go to an emergency room, you don't yet necessarily know what you have. You know what symptoms you have, or someone else may know the symptoms you have. And so sometimes very extreme conditions look like very mild conditions until you figure that out a little bit further. So this is just something to keep in mind, that, for example, chest pain that could signal heart attack could also look like heartburn. So we also found that communication and the sense of urgency may be different. So somebody may be able to indicate that they have a stomach ache or a headache or chest pain, but not necessarily the severity of that. So we applied for some internal funding to study this a bit before we really applied it to the data. And we wanted a methodology that would make more accurate categorizations of this utilization for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and also something that's useful across different data sources and across states. We wanted to not just do something in Massachusetts, but we wanted to be able to compare this. So we have a project with three steps, and one is to examine all the different methodologies that are out there and their application, then to refine as needed with the literature that we could find and clinical input, and to test the results on different sources of data, each which I think have certain strengths and weaknesses. So there was a systematic review done, ironically, by the University of Massachusetts, and we found this after we applied for the grant. But there were three types of, they grouped the different methodologies into three types. One is a diagnosis-based algorithm, and this is one of the most commonly that's used, particularly the model developed by New York University. And this uses ICD-9 codes related to the primary reason for discharge at the end of the visit. This is used in an adapted model by the CDC, and many states, including Massachusetts, have used this model. There's also a procedure-based model, which uses certain codes like CPT codes, which are current procedural terminology codes, and these distinguish between different intensities. This is based on admission, sometimes whether there was imaging done or certain procedures. There's also a triage-based methodology, which is generally using an internal system at a hospital. They're not consistent systems, and it may be determined on the time needed to wait and some intensity, but there we found a lot of inconsistencies there in terms of availability. So we were leaning towards the NYU model, which is validated as a predictor of future hospitalizations and mortality, and we thought that the diagnosis-based may be the most widely applicable, but that there may be some weaknesses in a disconnect between presentation and diagnosis, like I was talking about, and that the best model may include some additional information, like was the person hospitalized, or were there certain procedures or scans done that couldn't be done in a doctor's office necessitating the visit. So the NYU model was done on about 6,000 patients in two waves. It has not been updated in a while, and these patients were all from six Bronx hospitals. So initially we were thinking that there could be some challenges with generalizability in terms of the population that's outside the Bronx. In digging further, there have been some critiques of this model as well, and they have found that some conditions were coded as preventable or avoidable in some cases, and then not in others. So, for example, a chief complaint of chest pain in cases where it was decided it was heartburn was considered non-emergency, and then when it was chest pain not otherwise specified, which could be another way to code that, it was considered emergent. So there's a bit of challenges in terms of consistency here. We're also moving to ICD-10, and so we're mindful of that going forward. And we're concerned that with the 6,000 people, the more rare situations that you use the ER for may not have had enough people to really decide whether it was emergent or not. So they used things like presenting symptoms, vitals, medical history, age, and what happened during the visit to decide whether it was emergent or not. So this is the schema, a summary of how they break up the visits. And immediately we saw a problem in that the mental health conditions are screened out and do not go through this pathway. If it is a medical condition, it's either ruled as emergent or non-emergent, and from there, primary care treatable, and then into preventable or avoidable. There are three categories that they have used in the preventable, avoidable, and these are non-emergent. Those that require medical treatment within 12 hours, but that could be done at your PCP's office. And those that do need an emergency treatment, but that if you had received better care earlier down the line, probably would not have been an emergency. And just to give you a sense of how big of an issue this is some data from Massachusetts for the general population, and this may be hard to read, but about half of the visits to the ER were considered preventable or avoidable with this algorithm, resulting in about $56 million. And this was in 1 year. And of those, 23% are non-emergent and 21% required treatment within 12 hours, and very few of them were considered preventable with better outpatient care. And this is also from the general population, but I want you to pay particular attention to the things that are highlighted in red because we're going to compare them in a minute. So these are the top conditions that were in each of those types of categories. Things like headache, lower back pain. And I've highlighted here urinary tract infection, which I think for most of us would not necessarily require an emergency room visit. There's also things like abdominal pain and chest pain, which are general symptoms. And dehydration and seizures or other convulsions. So if we compare this to what we do know about the reasons that this population in mass was using the emergency room, we see some similarities. So the top reason was physical injuries, followed by seizures. And with the current algorithm, in many cases, this would be considered an avoidable visit. And I think we've found ourselves questioning whether that really is avoidable. We also see urinary tract infections here, but knowing that many of the populations we serve and from mortality reviews can develop septicemia very quickly from some of these infections, and they can become very serious. And so we're, I think, suspect as well in terms of ruling these just as a non-emergent condition. We also see cardiovascular symptoms here, in that chest pain may need to have a little bit more behind it in terms of our ability to understand, is it an emergency or is it not? So we have looked at the literature a bit in our step two. We first looked at literature on emergency medical services for people with intellectual disabilities in both the US and in other countries, particularly Europe and Canada, due to their similarities in systems. We found very few articles, there were 13. After we cleaned all of it and restricted it to adults. We also broadened it to a term of learning disabilities, which is both broader in the US and the term used in the United Kingdom and in much of Europe for intellectual disabilities, and we only found 3 relevant articles. So there's very little literature to compare beyond what we know in Massachusetts for this population. And when we looked at specific conditions to try to understand their development or needs for emergency services, we found very little literature there too. So in looking forward, we have a number of steps that we're going to consider. We still need to compare the NYU model seems to be our best bet, potentially with some modifications. But we need to compare that with the ambulatory care sensitive conditions, which we have been talking about in earlier sessions today. And we've learned of some proprietary models that aren't in the literature that are used by numerous groups, including Medicaid systems, to discern utilization patterns and high utilizers and inappropriate use. 3M makes one of them, and I know there's at least one more. So we need to understand those a little bit better to see if some of those are better or we can learn from them. We also need to continue our clinical review about some of these conditions and how to determine whether they might be require emergency use or not, and how we would do that. We have a number of data sources that we're going to use to test some of this, and I think a case review is ultimately what is going to inform this. So we have information from those incident reports that we were describing, and that includes a narrative of what was happening and leading up to the visit. I think that's really valuable information, in addition to the PCP involvement and what the PCP suggested if they were contacted. In addition, we do plan to apply this to Medicaid data and hopefully to all payer claims data, which is a resource we have in Massachusetts. It is legislatively mandated that all payers' medical services submit service level information to this database so we can look beyond just public programs. And we hope to test it in other states, including some of the Medicaid data and also in Canada and other countries. And this is our project team, in addition to me, at UMass Medical School. And this is our citation, so thank you.